Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Governor Kathy Hochul highlighted changes in New York's reading curriculum that were approved as part of the state budget. The governor said she hopes it will improve low reading scores among elementary school children. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt has more.
Beginning as early as this fall, children in New York will be taught to read using the phonics method. The technique teaches reading by having students sound out the word. It was common during the middle of the last century, but it fell out of favor in recent decades as what's known as the whole word method, which involves memorizing the entire word, took over. Hochul says data shows that the phonics method greatly improves children's reading skills, and she says the state will now return to it as part of her Back to Basics plan. She spoke at the Albany School of Humanities, a public magnet school for pre-K through sixth grade, where the phonics method has been taught since 2016.
And I'll tell you what, the numbers tell the story. The number of Albany students in grades 3 through 8 passing the state ELA exam has increased by nearly 50%. That's incredible. Let's give that a round of applause. I mean, that's...
Hochul says 67% of third graders in the school were found to be proficient in English, compared to the statewide average of just 45%. The state currently ranks in the lowest third of all 50 states for reading proficiency. The new state budget requires that all schools adopt the phonics method by the 2025-26 school year. It also provides $10 million to train 20,000 teachers at the State University of New York at New Paltz, where a micro-credentialing course in phonics is offered.
SUNY New Paltz is perhaps the only place in the nation that has a micro-credential in this, so we're sending teachers there to get this additional learning, and they're coming back and going right into the schools.
Hochul earlier dropped another education-related budget initiative. She wanted to end the provision known as Hold Harmless. That guaranteed that no school district received less money in the budget than it did the previous year. The plan proved unpopular among school leaders and state lawmakers, and it was scrapped in favor of a study to examine the best way to redistribute school aid based on whether a school district is losing or gaining population. Overall, the state is set to spend $36 billion on schools in the new fiscal year. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
Another New York college has announced its closure with just a few days' notice. Wells College in Aurora says it will shutter its doors at the end of the semester following years of financial challenges. As the Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports, the college has tapped a Westchester County University to take on some of its remaining students.
When freshmen John and Joe Bangle woke up Monday morning, they expected to start getting ready for finals. There's only a couple weeks left in the semester. But instead, the brothers from Canton, New York, are preparing to apply to schools all over again. John says they awoke to an email informing them that Wells was closing for good.
I didn't believe it. I asked a couple of my friends, and they said, yeah, it's true. I actually started crying because I really thought, you know, I was prepared to be at Wells for 4 years. And it was pretty sad knowing that I wasn't going to be there. But after that, I was already prepared to already look towards the future. So that's where I'm pretty focused on right now.
Wells, whose Finger Lakes campus has roughly 350 students, did not return a request for comment. In their email announcing the decision, President Jonathan Gibraltar and Board Chair Marie Carroll say the board has spent years trying to raise revenue and find other solutions to avoid closure, but that revenues, quote, are not projected to be sufficient for Wells' long-term financial stability, end quote. As recently as April 19th, the college was promoting itself to prospective students on Instagram, urging them to book tours of the campus and attend its accepted Students' Day. In its announcement Monday, the college named Manhattanville University in Purchase as its preferred teach-out facility. Manhattanville is a four-hour drive from Wells, just 30 minutes outside New York City, and has more than 2,000 undergraduate and graduate students. But President Frank Sanchez says he feels the two schools have similar enough backgrounds, campuses, and demographics to make for a smooth transition.
I think that there's a lot of, as you can imagine, for students and families, a lot of anxiety, maybe some uncertainty, some worry. You know, as the preferred teach-out partner, our goal is to reduce that anxiety, to answer questions, to provide that support.
Sanchez says Wells students who come to purchase will keep their current tuition rate, which is lower than Manhattanville's, as well as any scholarships. Manhattanville is dedicating a residence hall to keep Wells students together next year and creating an advisory board of Wells students to get their feedback during the transition. The Bengals say they're not sure where they're going just yet. John says they like the small town feel of Aurora. That's why they applied to Wells. But now that they've tried it, they're open to a larger school. Like many of their teammates, they're also trying to find a campus where they can continue playing the sports they love. And that might be the hardest part.
There are a good amount of teams that have, you know, the recruits already set and maybe the roster's already full, even though it's early. Right now, trying to find, you know, a basketball team for some people, trying to find a team that wants them and also wants their friends or, you know, the group is just almost impossible.
Wells is the latest in a string of small private colleges to close up shop in recent years. The College of St. Rose in Albany is closing in June, and Goddard College in Plainfield, Vermont is shuttering at the end of May. 2 years ago, when the nearly 200-year-old Cazenovia College announced its closure, Wells was listed as a teach-out facility for students. State Assemblymember Pat Fahey, a Democrat from the 109th District, chairs the Committee on Higher Education. She says a lot of campuses still haven't recouped the revenue they lost when the COVID-19 pandemic sent students home or deterred them from applying in the first place. Couple that with inflation and a general decline in enrollment, and some campuses simply can't stay afloat.
We are seeing a struggle with enrollments across the country, and our small independent colleges have really been hit, as well as our small SUNY and CUNYs. We had to see cutbacks at Fredonia most recently, and Clinton Community College and more.
Sanchez says Manhattanville is on an upswing. He says enrollment rose 5% in the fall, and the campus recently rebranded as a university. Long-term, Sanchez says Wells and Manhattanville are exploring a legacy agreement to incorporate the Wells name somewhere on the Manhattanville campus.
They're now part of our history, as we are part of theirs.
In addition to Manhattanville, Wells says it has developed teach-out agreements with Mercy University, Excelsior University, Hobart and William Smith Colleges, Keuka College, Lemoyne College, and SUNY Brockport. In a way, for the Bengals, it's like senior year of high school all over again. Everyone's getting ready to move, and they don't know if they're going to stick with their friends in the fall. But Joe says they will always have the memories.
We're going to get through this together. I mean, it's not just one or two people. It's everyone, including professors and staff and faculty and all of us. But, you know, we're tough people, and I would say don't count us out. We're always going to be Wellsians. We're always going to be a Wells family, no matter where we are.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with New York State Republican Assembly Minority Leader William Will Barclay. I began by asking Minority Leader to share his thoughts on what's wrong with the state budget.
Well, first of all, it's more of the same, unfortunately. We've had a spending addiction here in New York for the last, you know, decade or more. And unfortunately, to pay for all that spending, you have to tax. And we have $237 billion over 5 years. That's a $64 billion increase, 37% approximately. And unfortunately, New Yorkers can't afford that. And as a result, we're seeing, unfortunately, millions of people leave the state. So I think my biggest concern is the size of this budget. It doesn't seem like there's any political will to change that trajectory of just continuing to spend. whenever we have a politically difficult issue, instead of addressing that issue head on, we tend just to throw more money at it. And certainly this year was no difference than past years, unfortunately. You know, New Yorkers, we spend more on state and localities, about $15,000 per resident. That's 50% more than the U.S. average. So you can see how far out of whack we are with our sister states or, you know, the rest of the country.
Well, and similarly, when you remark about spending in the budget, we can look toward education and the idea that the governor, Governor Hochul, a Democrat, wanted to take away the provision called Hold Harmless, which would allow schools to get more money each year. The Democrats, particularly in the assembly, reacted negatively toward that. They say, no, we're not going to take money away from these school districts. And yet there's a problem with the basic foundation formula. You know, it's coming out of the property tax base, and it seems like no matter how the schools are funded, they're not funded equitably throughout the state. And to your criticism, it's more money being added to what may not be fair and equitable.
Right. So again, we spend, I think, almost $30,000 per student in New York State. That puts us at 91% of the national average. So we're well past the national average. So why do we spend so much? Well, I think you're right, Dave, because we're not directing school aid where it needs to go. In fact, instead of making those hard decisions of probably allocating school aid in an equitable way, we just add more money to try to make everybody happy. I wasn't against putting the Hold Harmless back in there, because I noticed that a lot of the schools that were harmed by that were rural schools, and actually low-wealth school districts.
Sure.
But those schools also, I mean, to agree with the governor to some extent, those are the schools that have lost student population. So going forward, we have to make some changes to our school districts, whether we do, and I think I mentioned this on the show, is whether we do consolidation might be the best bet going forward with those. And I know that's a politically hot-button issue. In fact, I think I told you in my own family, I mentioned that once and I almost got thrown out of the house. So I know that's difficult, but that proves my point that instead of making those difficult decisions, we're kind of just putting more money towards a problem. And again, this is not sustainable because New Yorkers simply can't afford it.
That's New York State Republican Assembly Minority Leader Will Barclay. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. College campuses around the U.S. have seen intense protests over Israel's war in Gaza, more than 6 months after the Hamas attacks. At the same time, one survivor of the October 7th massacre continues to speak out about his experiences. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas with more.
Matan Boltax is a 23-year-old Israeli-American originally from Great Neck, Long Island. He moved to Israel with family in 2009 and served in the Israel Defense Forces for 3 years as a sniper on the Gaza border, Lebanon border, and West Bank. But his close call with death came October 7th at the Supernova Music Festival.
There's a very large electronic music scene in Israel. A lot of popular DJs that play in parties, raves, festivals around the world actually are from Israel. My dad likes to call these like raves or festivals that we go to, like modern day, like Grateful Dead concert. The Nova is like it's like a production that has festivals around like 2-3 times a year. And this was by far their biggest one.
The producers had collaborated with a festival from Brazil, and 3,000 fans turned out.
The festival took place on the last day of the Jewish holiday of Sukkot. I live in Yad Binyamin, which is about 40 minutes up the coast from the Gaza border. So it was about an hour drive away from our home. It's a popular festival spot, because it's usually green year-round and there's lots of open spaces in between the small town for there be able to blast loud music, I guess. The festival started at midnight and it was supposed to go on until 5 p.m. So everyone's really in for a long haul. So everyone's bringing a lot of camping gear and food and snacks, water, drinks, whatever they need for such a long haul. So we got there at around 2 a.m.
Baltac says the last day of the holiday in Israel is comparable to the last day of summer in the U.S., with a new school year about to begin. At the campsite, Baltac met 23-year-old Hirsch Goldberg Polin, a U.S. citizen who lived in Virginia until recently moving to Israel with his family.
At around 6:15, we all got up, got ready for the day. We're about to take like the 5-minute walk over to the dance floor. And then we looked up in the sky at around 6:30 and saw a rocket.
Baltac says although Israelis are somewhat accustomed to seeing rockets, it was alarming to see them while situated in a huge open area. He says festival goers dashed to their vehicles and began a mass exodus. Baltac was one of the last people to see Goldberg Polin, who lost an arm to a grenade while seeking shelter and was subsequently taken captive by Hamas and is being held hostage in Gaza. Baltac and his group stayed at their campsite, a decision that saved their lives. He says by 6:55, the festival ground was nearly empty. Police patrolling the area told them to go home. They arrived at the parking lot at 7:10 a.m.
Drove about 500 yards to the intersection to get back on the highway to head home. And we hit standstill traffic. We got out of our car. I was with one of my friends in our car. We got out, tried to get an idea of what was going on because there was really like nowhere to go. This whole time, the rocket fire is still being shot at us. And I mean, just loud explosions, which make everything way more hectic. Police were doing a very good job of kind of controlling the crowd until they started getting shot at.
Moltec says things went downhill quickly. Police blocked off the main entrance to get back on the highway. He says people were driving against traffic, coming back with shattered windows, flattened tires, some bleeding with bullet wounds. A lot of people began running away, but Baltac and his friends pushed abandoned vehicles out of the way so they could drive through. Baltac says minutes later, Hamas reached the highway and festival grounds and shot anyone in sight. Baltac and friends drove for about a mile before hitting a dead end.
And then up ahead, we saw a pickup truck with Hamas militants in the back, not looking at us, but looking the other way. And so we quickly made a U-turn. All the communications were knocked out. So like Google Maps wasn't working. Couldn't call our friend.
Baltac says they picked up a couple in their 30s who were apparently in shock and drove on along an unfamiliar highway.
Clearly, we really had no clue where we were going. And we stopped in the first town we saw to take shelter in this family's house that we had no clue who they were, but they kindly let us in.
The group stayed at the house for 12 hours, then cautiously drove home. During that time, Baltac appeared on missing person lists being circulated on social media. Baltac says he is lucky to have made it out alive and uninjured. He recently traveled to the U.S., sharing his story with students at 7 colleges and universities along the East Coast. He says he never thought he'd see this much anti-Semitism.
So I did get to speak to a lot of the Jewish students on the campuses I went to. Also, when I spoke at SUNY Albany, which my dad actually happened to go to school there. I mean, just the fact that I spoke to a bunch of students who were losing friends or had to move out of their apartment because all of a sudden these college students who have no idea what they're talking about think that it's trendy or woke or cool to support Palestine when they have no base to their claim. So, and now all of a sudden they find these Jewish students who are going to Albany or these schools find themselves with people they thought who were their friends who actually dislike them or hate them or are calling them names or yelling anti-Semitic chants at them.
Baltac wishes protesters could visit Israel to better understand what the country is really like. He says he and his friends vowed to keep on staying optimistic, celebrating life, and dancing again in memory of all the other friends they have lost. A study released this month by the Anti-Defamation League found that during 2023, anti-Semitic activity reported on U.S. college and university campuses increased by 321% from 2022. The states with the highest number of incidents reported were California with 1,266, New York 1,218, New Jersey 830, Florida 463, and Massachusetts 440. Those five states accounted for 48% of the total incidents.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Surrounded by the Hudson River, the Hudson Athens Lighthouse has stood for 150 years. And now, a new recognition is boosting the effort to ensure it stands for 150 more. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard explains.
As the lighthouse watches from across a swollen springtime Hudson River, Athens Mayor Amy Sirago jokingly refers to the structure as the small village's 1,587th resident.
The lighthouse has stood off our shores for most of our village's nearly 220-year history. As a beacon and as a symbol of that history and the ingenuity that went into its construction in 1874.
The Hudson Athens Lighthouse, just off the southern tip of the Middle Ground Flats Island, is a stately two-story brick structure with an attached tower that still guides boats today. But it's in danger.
Threat. We are threatened. That's quite a word to have to, that's my job to describe for you.
Van Calhoun, who is head of the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society's Restoration Committee, points across the river as a tugboat pushes a huge stone barge past the lighthouse.
It's not the wakes that they put up. It's what it takes to drive those big stone barges, which go deep, 40 feet, 30 feet deep into the river. It's the turbulence of those props that go through, that go by, that are causing our damage. That's a small ship.
This barge is nothing compared to the 700-foot ocean-faring ships that head up the Hudson, says Calhoun. The ship traffic, he says, is washing the mud away from the pilings that hold the lighthouse in place. The Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society has been working for years to raise money to save the structure. The effort has gained the attention of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Pam Bowman, the organization's senior director of public lands policy, traveled to Athens for the event.
I'm joining you here today to announce that the Hudson Athens Lighthouse has been named to the National Trust's 2024 list of America's 11 most endangered historic places.
The National Trust has published the list each year since 1988. With an estimated $7 to $10 million needed to restore the lighthouse, the list shines a national light on the structure.
We hope that the listing of this lighthouse as an endangered place will spotlight and uplift this group's great work as they face increasing structural and funding challenges. Support and investment in their fundraising efforts could help protect this iconic beacon on one of America's greatest rivers.
The view from the Athens riverfront is great, but it's better to see the lighthouse up close. After a short boat ride and a short climb up the metal stairs to the lighthouse, Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society President Kristen Gamble stands at the back door that overlooks the muddy estuary.
Now, like most places these days, you walk into the kitchen. We're going to walk into the kitchen first instead of the front door, okay?
The inside of the lighthouse looks like a house, at least a house from the 1930s when a family lived here full time. Gamble points out the antique kitchen cabinet.
This is an old-fashioned Hoosier cabinet, if you know those. And you would the flour would be here in that.
Inside the rooms, there are photos, a display case of historic pieces, and an intricate prism that would have sat atop the building's tower. Local second graders are some of the annual visitors to see the interior of the lighthouse. But the building is showing more than its age. There are cracks in the walls and ceiling. The group has received $2.5 million state parks, preservation, and heritage grants and continues to raise funds. Holding up an engineering report, Gamble explains the extensive restoration project the Preservation Society is looking to complete.
We did a boring of the bottom of the river last fall, and we discovered that actually the bedrock is 80 feet deep. So we will have to go down pretty far in order to encircle. What the plan is to encircle, first repair, push the mud back over the pilings, and then you have to have the rocks, which are the what they call riprap, to hold the mud in place.
To get the best view, you have to climb the tower.
Okay, so now let's go all the way up.
The top deck offers a 360-degree view of the river, with the Catskills to the west and the Berkshires to the east.
There it is.
Gamble describes it as an emotional rush.
You know, just being up here and seeing this beautiful river and the mountains and, you know, the sky, it's so fabulous. It's inspiring. Huh. What can I say?
If you'd like to see it for yourself, the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society offers Saturday tours beginning this month.
Thank you. There we go.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2418. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics for the Legislative Gazette. I'm David Gustino. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.